Hi, I'm Nathan Ryder, and welcome to the Viber Survivors podcast, where I talk to PhD graduates about their research, their Viber, and life after the PhD. This is episode 39, and today I'm talking to Dr. Denise Proudfoot, who completed a professional doctorate in health at Bath University in 2014. Denise's thesis was titled A Narrative Exploration of the Experiences of Mothers Living with HIV in Ireland. It was really great to talk to her about her research topic, and also about her experiences of doing a professional doctorate and how she prepared for the Viber. It's great to have you on the podcast today, Denise. So, hello.
Hello, Nathan. Hi.
And to start us off, could you tell us a little bit about your research and how you came to do a professional doctorate?
Okay. Well, my research was I did a study, a narrative study with Irish-based HIV-positive mothers. And I suppose the reason there's a bit of a backstory as to why I went with that. I suppose what I set out to do was to provide understanding of their lives. And I'm originally a nurse, and I worked. I'm currently now based in Dublin in DCU in Ireland, but prior to that, I worked as a nurse in London. And I worked specifically with people who are HIV positive, and most of my caseload at the time were women. And at the time, in relation to HIV, it was around the sort of late 90s, the treatments had started to improve, and essentially the options for people who are HIV positive improved, but specifically in relation to mothers and their babies. When I was originally working as a nurse in HIV, there was limited options for drugs to be given to mothers during pregnancy that would have prevented the babies having HIV. And in around the sort of mid-1990s, the development of combination therapy, which is a combination of antiretroviral drugs, had a significant impact on the health of people with HIV, and equally had a significant impact on the chances of a pregnant HIV-positive woman having a baby, a HIV-positive baby. So I suppose that's had a huge impact really on the lives of mothers and women who are HIV positive. So when I decided to do a doctorate, I was trying to think about research, and very much one thing I wanted to do was to do something I was passionate and interested in. And I still had a lot of interest in HIV, even though my work currently, I lecture mainly, my background is mental health nursing and general nursing. So I'd lecture a lot on sort of nursing and sexual health, addictions, that sort of sphere. But I decided to go back to HIV. And so what I really wanted to look at is what's it like for women now, you know, sort of in the sense in the last sort of 15, 17 years, what's it like to be a mother? Because the mothers remain HIV positive. So increasingly the chances of your baby being born with HIV are very low. HIV positive women now would take medication in the second trimester of their pregnancy, and this reduces your chances of having a HIV positive baby to less than 1%. So I guess a lot of the work in HIV then, there's been huge advances and huge developments in the area of HIV, have been around the kind of biomedical discourse, and a lot of research is around mothers and around this, what's known as vertical transmission, is this preventing the HIV from mother to baby. So I guess I wanted to really look into the sort of social meaning of this process, and kind of adapting, you know, I took a sort of feminist mothering research approach in that. So really explore what's it like to be a HIV positive mother, and I guess maybe give voice to these women. So so that's really where I came to my idea for my research.
Okay, well that's really interesting. So you said you were in London at the time. So how did you, I suppose, make the transition from working in that area, or in the area, as you said, of mental health nursing and general nursing? How did you then find a supervisor or start the research?
All right. Well, the London, there was a gap. There was a gap between London and me starting my doctorate. So
okay.
So I was working in London, and then I moved back to Ireland. And since I came back to Ireland, which in sort of early 2000s, I'd been working as a lecturer in nursing. So then kind of around 2005, 2006, I contemplated, a lot of my colleagues had started PhDs or doctorates, and I kind of knew it was inevitable that I would want to do one. And so then I started looking at options. So I came across then the doctorate in health at Bath University, and I started that in 2007. As a part-time student, so I was combining that with my lecturing.
What was it like to actually do the research? Because from the correspondence we had, I'm guessing that you weren't just looking at literature about women with HIV, mothers with HIV. You were talking to them, you were interviewing
them.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, so just, I suppose, a comment really on the literature. I mean, there's been little research, say, in the last even 10, 12 years, so around women's experiences, or specifically mothers' experiences. There's been something, and any research that's explored women, HIV-positive women's lives, or aspects, you know, maybe to do with stigma, or just their maybe quality of life, etc. A lot of it, if they're mothers at all, it came up as a topic, even though it wasn't necessarily the focus of the initial research question. So I guess that was, when I was looking at my lit review, that suggested to me this is something that's important to HIV-positive women. So what I actually did then, my actual study was, as I said, I did a narrative study. So I interviewed 11 mothers who were attending a HIV peer support centre here in Dublin. And the mothers were kind of age-wise, they were kind of, I had kind of a broad enough sort of criteria, but they ranged, in the end, my sample ranged from grandmothers to mothers of sort of children of two. So we had mothers of children in their 30s right down. So I had quite a broad range of women who spoke about their experiences.
Okay, and did you, were there any big ethical, not so much problems, but were there ethical considerations with the kind of study that you did?
Yeah, there were. Certainly when I was getting ethical approval at Bath, one thing came up was around sort of disclosure, if there's anything around disclosure around sort of care of the child. That was something that I had to add in to my consent form, that if anything was divulged, that I would have to respond and act on it. I think one of the big things around ethical was around confidentiality. And at one stage when I got kind of caught up about having written consent for people who are HIV positive, how would I manage the consent forms, because of what you put on a consent form. So obviously if somebody has participated in research around HIV, if that form, if it went missing or somebody came across it. So there were a couple of issues around that. The other thing about confidentiality in Ireland, because it's again quite a small country, you're talking about a small population as well. But the reality, once I got going, I mean, the research was very enjoyable, and I'm sure most people say this, the actual data collection, which was interviews with the mothers and the women, was really interesting and relatively straightforward. Just a couple of things around their availability due to the demands of being mothers. Sometimes they weren't able to meet me or their children. They had to get back to collect children from school. But the actual, that side of it was relatively enjoyable and very insightful.
Okay. And did you have, for those interviews, did you have like a specific structure or set of questions you were following for all of them? Or was it a kind of exploring things? How did that work?
Yeah, I was exploratory, but I had a sort of interview schedule. So and I started really with a very broad question, can you tell me about your experiences of being a HIV positive mother? And for some of them had children before they had HIV. Others others were HIV positive and they were pregnant when they found out they were HIV positive. And then other women were known to be HIV positive and then decided to have children. So they were different. So they responded to that question in different ways. But most of them spoke really about their diagnosis was the kind of first where they sort of, and where that was on their kind of mothering trajectory. And then it, the kind of, you know, I asked them then about experiences of stigma, support, different aspects of kind of being a mother. So that once you kind of, it's like a lot of things, the first couple of questions, and then they start to respond and start to relax, and they were reasonably open about their experiences after that.
Yeah. What sort of what sort of things did you discover from doing this research? What was the impact?
Well, I suppose one thing I you know, it's one of those things that I summarise in the sort of near the end of my thesis, is I guess my key thing is being a mother impacts on the HIV experience, and vice versa, being HIV positive impacts on the mothering. But yeah. For a lot of the women, I suppose what I found out was that when they're diagnosed, their priority is their children. So if you don't have children, you know, the first thing they wanted to know was, could my child be HIV positive? And this really was irrespective of the age of the child. So as I said, some of them were pregnant. So women who were pregnant would have to wait until after they had their babies, and there would be a period of a couple of months before they would know if the children were HIV positive. Others then had young children. Others had, as I say, maybe older children or actual teenagers. But that was an interesting finding. So they were very child-centred. And this impacted on their response to their HIV result. Things I found out that stigma, I mean, there's a lot in a sense, because HIV has become increasingly normalised. Stigma remains a concern. You know, people managed it in different ways, but it certainly isn't something that's, you know, been eradicated by the normalising of HIV. And what I mean by the normalising of HIV is that it's increasingly seen as a chronic illness that can be treated. Some of that normalization has lessened, I guess, the psychosocial aspect of HIV. Another thing that was a concern for these women was telling their children. When do you tell them? Do you tell them? When is the right age? And this varied. You know, as I said, some had adult children who didn't know. A lot of the mothers too, they minimised HIV, so they focused, their primary role was as mothers. So HIV was something that they had to deal with, it was part of their lives, but they tried to keep it in the background. I suppose one of the last findings I thought was interesting as well, as I said, the women were part of a HIV support centre. Really important that they met other women in a similar position. They found that very useful, because it's quite an isolating condition to live with. Quite a few of my sample were migrant women, were asylum seeking women in Ireland. And they, by the nature of that, can be quite isolated. So they did find that really useful to meet other women at the centre and be open about being HIV positive.
Right. OK. I mean, it sounds like you discovered quite a lot, really. You know. So what was it like, what was it like as a researcher? So what I mean is, I think you said you started in 2007, and I know that your Viva was 2014. Mm-hmm. So what was it like working part-time? And also, you did a professional doctorate, and you knew people that were doing PhDs. And I was just curious whether you felt there were any differences between, you know, the people that you knew who were doing PhDs and your experience as of doing a professional doctorate.
So I think there's quite a few differences. The reason I chose a professional doctorate was I liked the structure, and I also like working as part of a, you know, kind of peer element, which was quite strong in my group. So the first couple of years, so I suppose while it seems a very long time, the first couple of years really we did a lot of research training, which I guess, and we looked at both quantitative and qualitative methods, which I think was quite important. So we had assignments. So I guess that would be one difference, say, from a PhD, where it probably has a narrower focus, or you stay in one, either quant or qual, from very early on. So the structure, as I said, was good. So you kind of gradually moved through. You could see there were kind of milestones through that, certainly the first 2 years, and then you did your transfer interview then once you had your proposal ready. So I think that's one difference, is that you're journeying with other people. The majority of the people on the doctorate were mature students, so a lot of them were quite senior professionals across kind of health disciplines. So that was quite interesting. So you have an interesting group of people to work with. I think the scope was quite broad, really, with the doctors in health. So quite a few people then were actually clinicians. Whereas I was supposed was a little bit different coming from an academic perspective. I'm trying to think other differences. I suppose the thesis then is smaller in the end as well, but it's very much quality rather than quantity. So my eventual thesis was about 45,000 words. So I guess one of the skills you develop in doing a doctorate, you have to be quite succinct. So that's another skill I guess I learned through it. But I felt I got colleagues mentioned, I think I got a good overall research training, as well as then I obviously made a choice to go down the qualitative and the narrative route. But I do feel I have a better understanding of other methodologies than I might have got if I had done a PhD, which I thought was useful for me now as working as an academic, if I'm involved in supervision in that I have a little bit more understanding. But I would see myself very much in the qualitative arena still. But I think that was another advantage of the doctorate.
Well, brilliant. I'm always interested to hear about people's... There's just so many different layers to doing research, and it's not just the knowledge that you find, but also I think, like you just said, the learning that you took from it as well in how to do research. That's really great to hear.
I think the other thing as well, yes, I was juggling work, so I was working full-time. So I was a full-time academic lecturer and a part-time student, so I don't know what that makes me. That nearly makes me into two people. But and that was quite challenging, but also because I was in an academic environment, I think that helped. And so I had a lot of resources that, as I said, some of my other colleagues maybe were working in, say, in a primary care context or in a more medical or clinical context. So I think that was an advantage to me. So a lot of my colleagues were researchers, were doing doctorates, PhDs, and equally we would have had senior colleagues who were active research. So I did have that resource, which I think did help. But at times, there was a lot of juggling. There was a lot of weekends and evening work, of course, as part of the course.
Yeah, I suppose it is, isn't it?
And two children. Yeah.
And two children.
Two children to keep an eye on as well. So yeah.
I've only got the one who's 18 months old now, and that's been a big adjustment the last 18 months.
The constant, going up to, typing or kind of having to do work. And that's the nature of any commitment like this is, kind of your weekends or and trying to juggle that with family life and work life. So at times it was pressurized, but I guess the end goal, and some of that was related obviously to supervisors as well, people keeping you going. And there was various stages through the process where it was, as I said, the data collection was really good and that motivates you. And then you have your, transcribing. So there was, so it wasn't a constant at a heavy pace. There was different periods across the sort of probably the last 3 years that it would have been busiest really for me.
Yeah. So when you had finished your thesis and you were submitted, what sort of things did you do to start preparing for the viva? I suppose another question with that is, how long did you have between submission and your viva date?
Right. I submitted in June. So I was working towards a kind of May deadline, but eventually it was June. And at the time, I didn't realise that wasn't a brilliant time, because obviously very quickly you hit into summer. But in a sense, for me, it was kind of getting it done, getting it finished. So I submitted June, and the process then about sorting, I had my external had been appointed an internal examiner. So I had hoped for having a viva around September. I was quite happy to do it in August, but eventually it was mid-October. So it was essentially over nearly 4 months before I actually had it. And I, at the time, I found that quite difficult, but I think I needed a break from it all. So I managed then to have a reasonable break from my thesis and then enough time to go back and read it. So I would have started kind of preparing from kind of September onwards, once I had my date for my Viva. And I guess the preparation varied. So I looked at your e-book. I had that for a couple of years beforehand. Various YouTube, and I looked at kind of ones of people's experiences of Viva, equally then the supervisors, and across a range of subjects, but what they're looking for, or sorry, the examiners, not supervisors, what examiners are looking for, what their experiences of doing Vivas. And then the other resource, as I said, because I'm working in a university, as I spoke to colleagues who've had various Viva experiences themselves, some positive, some quite difficult. So that helped me. I think the other thing then I did was read my thesis. So somebody advised me, said, you need to know your thesis inside out. And you kind of think, well, I've been working on it. Of course I do. But I did, and I found that quite difficult to go back over it and read it and kind of clarify. You know, again, there was some, maybe in relation to theory, exactly what did I mean here? What was I doing here? And then nearer to the Viva, then I kind of did a session where I looked for typos and, you know, again, if there was any errors that I could see. So that was the kind of preparation.
So you mentioned looking around various people's experiences and their reports of that. Did you get any specific advice about the Viva, either from, you know, colleagues or from your supervisors? Was there anything anyone told you about it?
I think the best advice I got, and I can say this now having been through it, was that it's my Viva. So somebody said to me, take control, it's your Viva. You know, and I found, and in a sense that was quite a, until you've gone through it, it's, you know, you kind of, well, what do you mean take control? But I very much used sort of, well, this is my opportunity with the two examiners. So but I think that was one of the best pieces of advice. So, I mean, I was prepared as much as I could. I mean, there was still, you know, there still was that uncertainty, you know, what if it didn't go well, or what if, you know, I suppose you hear, because you hear so many different things about Viva, you know, you, until you actually go through one to yourself, it's hard to know how it'll actually be. But I think that was one of the best, you know, so take control, so, you know, and I suppose try and manage that while you're in the Viva.
Yeah. Did you have a mock Viva or anything like that?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. How was that experience?
Yeah, I suppose one thing to comment, I suppose, going back to my journey on my doctorate, is a lot of my supervision was via Skype. So I'm based in Ireland. My two supervisors, one was in Bath and one was in London. So a lot of it was Skype plus email. So that was quite challenging, because you don't have that face-to-face contact. So, you know, maybe sometimes when people are doing PhDs and they're working with their supervisor and they're seeing them maybe weekly, I didn't have that. So I found that quite challenging. So then my mock Viva was essentially via Skype with my two supervisors. I found that useful. Again, you know, the questions, they were quite challenging. I think they were, compared to the real Viva, I think the questions were a bit more focused on, say, on my topic area around HIV and the mothering and some of that. But I did find it useful. I think I found it useful to talk it through and articulate myself around, you know, I knew there were, I was going to be asked about methodology. I was going to be asked about key tech. So, you know, actually verbalising that was really useful. Rather than kind of hemming and hawing and kind of not really sure about that.
Yeah.
I also then had a discussion with a colleague where she just went through some, you know, typical Viva questions and just asked me again. And that was more just giving me a bit of confidence to talk it out. She wasn't really challenging me, but she was just helping me. How did I sound when I answered? You know, why did I pick narrative research, and what were my key findings, you know, any challenges, though, you know, standard enough questions. So I found that useful, and that was, again, non-threatening, but definitely the mock Viva was useful for me, and that was just under a week before the actual Viva.
Okay, so on the day of the Viva itself then, how are you feeling? I suppose another question that just sprung to mind is, was your Viva in Bath, or was your Viva over Skype as well?
No, fortunately. I think Mach 5 is bad enough on Skype. No, I travelled over and my sister-in-law came with me. So I had somebody with me, which I think was quite useful, and she's not connected to academia, so it was quite nice to have somebody who was just really there in a supportive role. So the day of the Viva, I guess I would describe myself as excited and nervous. You know, it was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so I had that morning, and I was fine until I went to the university, so I kind of had breakfast and all that. But once I went up to the university and, you know, kind of found the room, and I had gone, you know, an hour and a half before it, then it kind of suddenly hit me, oh God, this is it. And it was like life will never be the same afterwards. A bit dramatic, but I did, I was quite nervous on the morning. What else would I try to think of? Something else?
Okay. No, that's fine. So how did the Viva start then? Had you met both of your examiners before?
My external I had met briefly at a conference, but as I say, he wouldn't necessarily have remembered me, so it was just a conversation at a conference. And the internal I hadn't met before, but I had looked up some of their research. But obviously my actual external, I had used quite a bit of his work in my own thesis, whereas the internal, so I did look up her sort of research and stuff in advance. So I hadn't met them before, and there was just them. There was no chair in my Viva, so it was just the three of us in quite a small room. So, you know, it was quite an intimate setting, so it was quite nice, relatively relaxing. It started, it was about maybe 10 or 15 minutes late starting, and very much one of the first things they asked me, similar to the question, you know, why did you do what you did and what was your interest? So I kind of was expecting that kind of warm-up question. So I gave a little bit of background, and that was useful to kind of, I suppose, settle myself down a little bit.
Yeah. So what was the format of the Viva like then? Because you didn't have to give any kind of presentation and they asked you that question, but how did it proceed from there?
Well, really, it kind of went through, I suppose, different components of the thesis. So they asked me, you know, about key literature. It didn't go completely in sequence. And I guess my external kind of took the lead more so, because he was more the methodological expert in that, so he kind of led it. I suppose when I was thinking back about how it felt, there was a lot of clarifying and maybe helping me to kind of expand maybe on some aspects of the thesis. One thing I did, which my supervisor thought was quite strange, was I did a PowerPoint of... So basically I had a slide for nearly every chapter, or maybe a slide for two slides for my findings. Now, I actually brought that in with me to my Viva, and one of the examiners said, oh, you're very well prepared. And I think this was back to the point of taking control. And I didn't really flick through it, but I kind of felt it was comfortable, and it was a kind of comfort thing, and I could look at, you know, and I did actually a couple of times stop and look at my slide in my hand. It was printed off in my hand, so I did actually use that. I don't know if I'd recommend that, but it helped me.
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that, because sometimes I think one time in the last few weeks when I've done a workshop, somebody said, well, won't your examiners think that's you know, that it's wrong or it's bad, or, you know, there's something negative about being prepared. But my sort of thought on that was that your examiners will probably think that that's a good thing, that you have prepared for the Viva, surely?
Yeah. I mean, it was like, essentially it was slides with just with bullet points. But, you know, the way there's some, I suppose, some aspects, something that you've said, you've written it, but sometimes it's hard to, how will I verbalise things? So, I did, you know, occasionally I said, can I, you know, and I didn't take a huge amount of time, but certainly something, one of the preparation things was, you know, take your time. So I did, and I would be naturally relatively cool. So I said, I just need a sec, I'm just going to check my notes, and I did. But they didn't seem bothered by it, it worked for me, I guess.
Yeah. So you mentioned feeling maybe nervous and excited before the Viva. Was it stressful being in there, or was it Was it fine?
Initially it was stressful, but very quickly I relaxed. And again, I suppose I was the, you know, I was the expert in my study. So I got over the first two or three questions, and as I say, one of the first question I spoke quite obviously my long answer back as to why I did my study. Then it became more like, I guess, a critical discussion. So I think once I relaxed, it was fine really. They didn't ask me any questions. It completely threw me. But I did. I know near the end of it, I started to get a bit tired, and I kind of a couple of times I said, oh, I have to think about that. So. You know, I did, as I said, I took my time through it, but I was quite relaxed, I'd say within 10 minutes, and it wasn't stressful after that.
Yeah. So how you just mentioned then sort of feeling tired towards the end maybe, but how long was your Viva?
It was about an hour and 20 minutes, so okay. Yeah, it wasn't too long.
Did it seem like it was taking that long, or did it seem like it just passed by really quickly?
Reasonably quick. I mean, it. I was expecting it to be an hour to an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. So that would be, you know, quite typical in the area I'm in. So I wasn't expecting it to 3 or 4 hours. I know in the more science-based ones, that can be quite long. So no, it was comfortable. I think there was always that little thing. Oh, are they going to ask me something really awkward? Or but it didn't happen. So no, the time was fine. It was fine.
Yeah. Just before we move on, were there any questions that were particularly challenging, you know, that sort of challenged something you'd done, or was it more a case of you using the time, like you said, to think about how to put your answer across?
To be honest, there wasn't, and I think I was a bit surprised at that. So there was an element of kind of clarifying. As I said, my extern was he's an expert in narrative research, so he kind of, I guess, probed me a little bit on some aspects of my study, but really more to kind of help me articulate it a little better and defend it a little bit better, I guess. So he kind of said, are you sure? You know, it wasn't that he was challenging me. I think he was just facilitating me to be clear as to what I found and why I did what I did. So that was more so around the methodology. But there wasn't any questions. I think quite near the end, I was asked kind of the standard question, what was your contribution to? And at that stage, I felt like I found that quite hard to answer, because I think I'd expected it quite early. And I didn't really answer that as clearly, because I think I was at that stage, I was quite tired. But, you know, that was one question I expected earlier in the Viva that came relatively late.
Okay. So how did you feel when it was finished? did they tell you your results straight away, or was it after a small break? How did that work?
So there was a break. So they, you know, I remember the ending, they sort of said to me, you know, we're finished now. Is there anything else you'd like to say? And I was kind of thinking, oh, I'm a bit disappointed. I think I would have liked to talk more, if I said more about my kind of more the nuance of my findings and what this study meant, I guess, a little bit to me. But, you know, it finished reasonably. It was nice. And they said, can you wait outside? So it was quite close to my supervisor's office. So I waited outside with him probably for 15 minutes and just discussed with him what I had said and what had happened. Then they invited me back into the room, and straight away they said, congratulations, Dr. Proudfoot. And that was kind of, oh my God, it was a bit surreal, you know, the moment. And they said, you've essentially got minor corrections. And I was kind of, wasn't expecting that at all. And really there was very little discussion. It was just, you've done really well, really enjoyed it. And by in Bath, minor corrections, there's, you know, like a lot of universities, different levels of corrections. I got the minor, which is less than you have a month to work on. And so there was no discussion about my actual corrections at that point. They were literally, when I got them, there were a couple of pages of literally typos and style. I think didn't really warrant a huge amount of work. So it was just celebration after that, really. It ended quite quickly then. It was about, you know, 5 minute conversation and, you know, best of luck, and that was it.
Yeah.
It was quite quick in the end.
Did you take a long time to do your corrections, or was it just a case of getting them done all in one go?
Well, I had, it was about 2 weeks before I received the actual correction. So that kind of gap, which was fine. And I was surprised actually when I actually got them, how hard I found to do them, considering that they were actually minor. So once I saw them and I said they wouldn't take me long. So, you know, a couple of hours really to go through them and, you know, just checking that I had the right version and, you know, PDF and things like that. And then I sent them back to the internal examiner, and then she came back again with a couple of additional. So she was very thorough in relation to them. But as I said, they were essentially typos, really. So I finished it all then within, I think it was just by early December. I think my deadline was the sort of early December, so I had it in on time, and it was quite straightforward.
Brilliant. Well, we're coming up towards the end of the podcast, and there's two questions that I always ask people on the podcast, and both around advice. So are you happy to share some of your advice and experience?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so to begin with, what advice would you give someone who was starting a doctorate?
What advice? I suppose I would think of your topic, what's your area of interest. I think my advice is go with something that you're passionate and are interested. It has to sustain your interest over quite a long period of time. So certainly from a part-time, you're looking at, you know, 5-6 years. So that would be one thing. And I think one thing I learned is, you know, that if you're determined and you stay with it, you know, and you know, work, there's going to be challenges. There's going to be times where you just want to throw it away and forget all about it. But I do think it is worth doing it. I mean, I think you learn an awful lot about yourself through the process. And I suppose, you know, what were the other things, the advice? I think keep going, really. And if things aren't flowing, take breaks, you know, so whatever that may be. So be it, you know, holidays, but I do think you need to sort of contain it as well, that there are times, and there'll be times where it's relatively straightforward, is that the data collection or maybe aspects of it were quite positive, and enjoy those. And then there'll be times where, you know, it will take a while to get your thinking clear about things. So there would be the kind of main things I think I would advise people. I do think it's a worthwhile, if it's something you're interested, I think it's a worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah. Well, great. That's really great advice to share. Thank you. Last question then is, what advice would you give someone who was preparing for their viva?
I would recommend, I think, a mock viva. I think that certainly is a useful thing to do. And I think going back over your thesis, I think you need a space. I think you need, I know sometimes the turnaround can be quite quick. Ideally, you need a break. You need to leave it for 2 weeks at least, or some, you know, reasonable gap, and then I think go back and try and look at it from a more critical perspective, and not get too bogged down by things like typos or, you know, if there's errors on table, small things like that, they can be addressed. But I think, you know, go back to kind of your key theoretical, you know, sort of arguments. Do you fully understand, you know, where you've made the link, your contribution, you know, and as I say, that point that somebody said, you know your thesis inside out. But that's, you know, it's quite challenging, I think, to do that without getting distracted by maybe, formatting or errors and that. That would be the main thing. And I think the other thing is that I suppose one thing I would finish off is that it can be an enjoyable experience. You know, that often the thought of it, and as you say, you'll hear various experiences, obviously, across your podcast. But I mean, largely, I think if you've done the work, you've worked well with your supervisors, and, you know, it should be a good experience, really.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today, Denise. And first of all, sharing some really interesting research, but also for sharing your viva experience as well and your advice. I know it's going to be helpful to a lot of people listening.
Okay, thank you, Nathan.
That's all for episode 39. Many thanks to Denise for joining me today and to you for listening. If you've got any questions or comments about this or any other episode, then please get in touch, either by commenting on the site or by emailing podcast@viva-survivors.com, or you can tweet @viva survivors or @Dr. Ryder. And if you'd like to come on a future episode, either to share your Viva experience or to talk about academic jobs or even your experiences as an examiner, then please get in touch. Until next time, I'm Nathan Ryder, and thanks for listening.